So today is my final lecture. After winter school, Jaume will take over and tell you about conformal field theories. And in my final lecture, I'd like to discuss chiral anomalies from the functional integral perspective. So as I alluded to last time, the origin of the chiral anomaly from the functional integral perspective comes from the fact that the measure is not invariant in general under a chiral transformation. So today we're going to see why that's the case and why that implies that the chiral current is not conserved. And the theory we're going to study is massless QED in four-dimensional Euclidean spacetime. So most of what I'm going to say doesn't depend too heavily on these assumptions. So the fact that we're considering QED instead of a more general non-abelian gauge theory has only a small impact, and I'll comment briefly on what will change in the case that we have a non-abelian gauge theory instead. So this is not essential. The fact that it's massless, it is essential, because if we have a massive theory, then there's no chiral symmetry. In fact, we're in four space-time dimensions. Again, is not critical. It, almost the same approach will work in other dimensions. And in tutorial, we'll look at what changes when we go to two dimensions, and we'll see it's quite similar. And the reason we're working in Euclidean space-time instead of Minkowski space-time is that this will simplify things significantly, because in Euclidean space, at least my choice of conventions, the Dirac operator, ID slash, is Hermitian. Which will have a number of important implications that we'll see as we study the chiral anomaly. Okay, so before we get started, just a few words on my conventions. So the gamma matrices satisfy the anti-commutation relations equal to 2 g mu nu. And I'm going to choose the correct convention, where the metric is all positive in Euclidean spacetime. That's the natural thing to do. Unfortunately, most of the references I've posted on the wiki choose the opposite convention. I don't know why, but just a word of warning in case you want to compare what we're doing in class to many of the references in the literature. And so in the chiral basis, we can write the gamma matrices as, well, there's some extra factors of I compared to what you're used to in Lorentzian signature. So in particular, the spatial gamma matrices have an extra I or minus I. Gamma 4, which is what I'll call the Euclidean version of gamma 0, just has 1s, identity matrices in the off diagonals. And gamma 5 is defined to be just the product of all the gamma matrices with no additional I's, unlike in Lorentzian signature. The particular form of these matrices won't be essential, so we're not going to, most of our calculation won't depend on the choice of basis. But what is essential, one fact about these gamma matrices that we will be using repeatedly, is that these gamma matrices are all Hermitian, unlike in Lorentzian signature. So these are all Hermitian. And that will play a key role in what we're going to do later. Okay. So the functional integral we're going to study, I'm going to call z of a. And I'll define it to be the functional integral over the fermion measure of e to the minus the Euclidean action of quantum electrodynamics, which depends on our fermion field as well as our gauge field. So notice here that I'm not integrating over the photon. So if you like, you can think of this as a functional integral where we're treating the fermion field fully quantum mechanically, but this is still an object that depends on A. So there's no integral over A. We're not yet quantizing A. I'll comment on what happens when we quantize A near the end. But like we saw last time, the chiral anomaly really comes from quantum effects in the fermion sector. So we won't need to treat the photon quantum mechanically, although the anomaly is still there even if we did treat it quantum mechanically. But we'll just leave out the A integral for now for simplicity. Okay. So what we want to do is try to determine the quantum version of the conservation equation. So we know that classically, d mu k mu 5 is 0. And so our goal today is to try to determine the quantum version of that. So we're going to determine a quantum version of this equation. What we're going to derive is an equation for the expectation value of the divergence of the occurrence. So this is our goal today, is to determine the right-hand side of this equation. If this current were conserved, we'd expect it to be 0. We will find that it's non-zero, and this non-zero term is precisely the anomaly. Okay, and so the way we can derive this equation is by performing a local chiral transformation on our fields. So under a local chiral transformation, psi goes to psi prime, which is e to the I theta of x gamma 5 times psi. So notice here, I'm allowing this transformation parameter theta to be a function of space-time. The chiral symmetry is only a symmetry if theta is a constant. So here we're doing something more general than we did last time. But this is essentially the sneaky recipe that David told you about in the front-end course. And this is one way we can derive the quantum version of our conservation equation. So we will, the action is not necessarily invariant if we promote theta to a function of space-time. We're not demanding that the chiral symmetry is a gauge symmetry. So we will, in general, get an extra term from doing this, but this will allow us to derive the anomalous non-conservation equation. And under this same local chiral transformation. Psi bar transforms into psi bar e to the I theta of x, gamma 5. And these transformations have the same sign because of the anti-commutation relation between gamma 5 and gamma 4. It's hidden in the psi bar. So remember, gamma 4 is the Euclidean version of gamma 0. And our gauge field is invariant under this local chiral transformation. So we're doing a local chiral transformation instead of a global one. So that means that our action will change. And the change can be shown, and it's shown in the notes, but I'm not going to go through the derivation now. So it's not invariant under this term. Under this transformation, we get an extra term, which is just the integral over spacetime of theta times the divergence of the chiral current. Okay, so under this local chiral transformation, our functional integral z of a is invariant. So remember, we're integrating over the Fermion field, not the gauge field. Z depends only on the gauge field. The gauge field is invariant. So if we do a local chiral transformation, that we're essentially doing a change of variables for our Fermion field. So that shouldn't change this functional integral. It only depends on A. A is invariant. So that tells us that, in particular, So z of a goes to z of a. And we can use this observation to determine the anomalous non-conservation equation. So if z is invariant, then the functional derivative of z with respect to theta.
Why is z invariant?
Z is invariant because a is invariant, and z is only a functional of a.
Oh, okay.
So if z is invariant, then the functional derivative of z with respect to theta should be 0, and in particular, it should be 0 at theta equals 0. It would be 0 at any value of theta, but theta equals 0 is a particularly convenient value to look at. So this is 0. And, well, let's look at what the functional derivative of z with respect to theta is. That's just functional derivative with respect to theta of x of the integral of, if we do our change of variables, or our local chiral transformation, z becomes integral d psi prime, d psi bar prime, e to the minus s minus integral d for x theta d mu j mu 5. All evaluated at theta equals 0. This is 0. And, well, if the measure were invariant, then what we would have, if the measure was invariant, this is not true, but let's just assume it's true for now. Then what this equation would tell us is, well, if we do a theta derivative, we just bring down a d mu j mu 5. And that would give, so then we would have on the left-hand side of the equation the integral of d mu j mu phi times e to the minus s, which is just the expectation value of the divergence of our chiral current. That's what we're trying to compute. And now this equation would tell us that's zero. So
are you assuming from the start that a current is conserved? Is that like true, or is it something you have to show?
This is true classically. So quantum mechanically, if we want to ask the same question, we should ask about the expectation value. And what we're going to find is that this is not equal to zero. Quantum mechanics and in the quantum field theory. So the classical equation is modified in the quantum theory. And so if the measure were invariant, this equation would tell us that quantum theory is the same as the classical theory. This is not true. So these are, this is not valid. And so we see that if we determine how the measure transforms, we can compute the anomalous non-conservation equation. And we'll compute it more carefully in a minute, but just let's see why we should expect that this is not true. So if we look at our equations over here. So our measure is basically, we need to look at how psi and psi bar both transform. And they both transform with an e to the I, plus e to the I theta gamma 5. So psi and psi bar transform in the same way. So we expect the measure should transform something like e to the 2i theta gamma 5. If we consider it instead just the usual non-chiral transformation where psi transformed to e to the I theta, we would have opposite signs, and those signs would cancel in the measure. So that's essentially where the non-invariance of the measure comes from. It's because psi and psi bar transform the same way. And we'll see that, in fact, our intuition is basically correct, and the anomaly is basically going to be related to this e to the 2i theta gamma 5. With one caveat. So as I mentioned last time, the regularization played a key role in determining the anomaly. So as one of the last things I said on Wednesday's lecture was that the whole story implicitly involved a regularization where we said that the charge didn't change. And so we're going to see the same thing here. If we just sort of naively follow through the argument I just gave about how we should expect the e to the 2i theta gamma 5, the extra term on the right-hand side of the anomalous non-conservation equation, we're going to find is ambiguous. It will basically be 0 times infinity. So we're going to have to regularize things carefully in order to get a meaningful result. So the regularization is going to play a key role. And the way we're going to regularize things is we're going to expand our functional integral in an eigenbasis of the Dirac operator. And so this is where the fact that we're working in Euclidean space and our Dirac operator and our gamma matrices are Hermitian will play a key role. So and this regularization will also help us think carefully about exactly how the measure will transform. So we expect something like e to the 2i theta gamma 5. We'll do that more carefully once we've regularized things. To regularize, we're going to expand in an eigenbasis. Of the Dirac operator. And let's call our eigenfunctions phi n. And so I d slash is Hermitian. So these eigenvalues are real. And let's make the further assumption that we're working in orthonormal eigenbasis. So we'll assume that d4x by n dagger by m is delta nm. So these are orthonormal eigenfunctions. And we'll assume, furthermore, they're complete. So we sum over the eigenfunctions, we'll get a delta x minus y and a delta alpha beta, where alpha and beta are the Dirac indices. These eigenfunctions have various components corresponding to the various Dirac components. Okay. So in terms of these eigenfunctions, we can write psi and psi bar and expand psi and psi bar in terms of these eigenfunctions. And let's call the coefficients in the expansion A and B bar. And these will be our Grassmann variables. OK. So now in terms of these eigenfunctions, we can write down what the measure is in our original variables, and then we can see how it transforms. So in terms of our original variables, d psi bar is just defined to be the product over the measure over each of these Grassmann variables. Builds these Grassmann variables basically specify psi and psi bar. So if we integrate over dan and dbn, we get we're integrating over all possible field configurations. Okay, and so we want to determine how this measure transforms. So the measure, after a local chiral transformation, we can do the expansion in terms of the same eigenfunctions, but the coefficients will change. Just the analog of a usual change of basis or rotation. And the an primes can be written in terms of the original a's. It's just the inner product of phi n with phi n prime, which since psi n prime is just a local chiral transformation of psi, can be written as phi n e the I theta gamma 5 psi bar. And we can write this as a sum over m using our expansion of psi in terms of the original eigenfunctions as am phi n e to the I theta gamma 5 phi m. And so this here is a matrix CNM that relates our new expansion coefficients to our old expansion coefficients. So, any questions on
this trick of, so in general, when we're taking the path integral, we were understanding it over field configurations. Say smooth field configurations that were like really wild spaces. And here it seems that the trick we're doing is that instead of considering a path integral over C infinity M, we're considering over a Hilbert space, which is much, in particular, over a second countable Hilbert space, so we'll have a countable basis. And that's how we've performed this uncountable integral in terms of an infinite but countable number of measures, right?
That's right.
And why didn't we do that before? Like, that seems like an easy way of introducing. That seems like like an easy way of introducing the path integral, right? In quantum mechanics. There must be a problem with this because otherwise we should just do that from the beginning, right?
Yes. So. I think the issues with doing this is in general, if we're in a infinite space-time, there can be regularization issues with this. So the way we worked, we might need to do some further regularizations of space-time for this to make sense, which I'm not going to go into here, but I think if you wanted to do this properly, have this on a fully sound mathematical basis. I think there probably are some additional regularization issues in the IR related to the infinite volume of space time. In a finite space time, I think this should work and should be another way of defining the path integral. It's different from the discretization of space time that we looked at in QFT2.
So it's finite because of compactification.
So we're going to focus on the UV issues, which won't don't really depend on the space-time we're working with, whether it's finite or not. If you wanted to be, I think there might be some additional subtleties that we're not going to go into here related to the IR and whether or not this basis exists, but. Those are some subtleties that can be worked out, and we won't go through all the details here. Okay, so we can relate our expansion of the transform fields to the coefficients of the expansion of our original fields. And so the measure we can then read off from this expansion. Since these are Grassmann variables, the measure just transforms with an inverse Jacobian of C, where C is this matrix whose entries are the C and M over here. And times our original measure. And we can write the determinant of this matrix as just the exponential. So C and M, the matrix elements are just the matrix elements of e to the I theta gamma 5. So we're taking the determinant of this matrix, which you can write in terms of the trace of the log. So we can write this as e to the minus trace of the log of C, which is e to the minus I times the trace of theta gamma 5. And what I mean here by this trace is both a matrix trace, so here gamma 5 is a matrix, but I also mean a functional trace. So in particular, trace of theta gamma 5 is just the integral of yes, so this is both a matrix and a functional trace. So the matrix trace here, I've inserted our complete set of eigenfunctions, and the matrix trace is indicated as the fact we've got the all of the Dirac indices contracted, and then the functional trace indicates that we are integrating over this complete set of eigenfunctions. And so we see that, well, this half of the measure transforms with e to the minus I trace of gamma 5. Since psi bar transforms in the same way as psi, we'll also get a e to the minus I trace of theta gamma 5 from the other part of the measure. And in total, our equation will be that 0 is equal to functional derivative of z respect to theta, evaluated at theta equals 0. And this is just the terms we had before, e to the minus s minus theta d mu j mu 5. And then we've now computed, or at least written down, a formal expression for the anomaly, which is just a minus 2i trace of theta gamma 5. So this term here is the anomaly, at least in a formal sense. To compute it, we need to actually impose a regulator and write this in a more physically meaningful way in terms of the fields. OK, so essentially what we need to do to compute the anomaly is to compute trace of theta gamma 5, which is just integral E4x. Delta 4 x minus x times theta of x trace of gamma 5, where I've just used this equation together with the completeness of our eigenfunctions. So the we get from the sum, we get a delta alpha beta, which means we're tracing gamma 5. We also get a delta of x minus x. And so we see here what I was alluding to before. We have something that's quite ambiguous and we can't really say much about without regularizing, because here we've got a delta of x minus x, which is infinity, and we have a trace of gamma 5, and this is 0. It's a trace of infinity times 0. Without a regularization, this is completely ambiguous. So we need to regularize this expression to get something physically meaningful. And the way we can do that is essentially by cutting off these eigenfunctions. So we're basically going to throw away the eigenfunctions with sufficiently large eigenvalue. It's essentially analogous to what we do in any other regularization. We throw away the large energy eigenvalues.
Are we missing the sum and the trace of theta gamma 5? Sum over M.
Sum over M, yes. Yes, so here for all of our indices, right? Implicit sum.
Sorry.
So, yeah. Sum over M, alpha, and beta. Okay, so trace theta gamma 5. Let's before we use the completeness, let's insert our regulators. So the unregulated expression for the trace of theta gamma 5 is the integral sum over n theta by n gamma 5 by n. And let's insert a regulator. So we want to get rid of the effect of the eigenfunctions with large eigenvalues. And one way we can do that is by inserting a function here, which I'll call f. Minus lambda n, where lambda are the eigenvalues, and big lambda is some large cutoff. And we'll, like we usually do, get rid of our regulator at the end of our calculation. So we'll take the limit lambda goes to infinity. And here we'll assume that f is some function that doesn't do anything to the eigenfunctions with small eigenvalue. So let's assume that f of 0 is 1. And we will assume, furthermore, that f of infinity and all of its derivatives at infinity are 0. So that for large eigen the eigenfunctions with large eigenvalue will be have a negligible effect. We'll remove those in order to regularize this trace. Okay. So the precise form of our regulator of our function f won't matter. We could choose like this to be exponential of e to the minus x. That satisfies these assumptions, but the precise form won't matter. The next thing we can do is we can go to Fourier space. We do a Fourier transformation. This becomes integral d4x, d4k, 2 pi to the fourth, 4k prime, theta e to the minus I k prime dot x, and we'll use the fact that phi n's are eigenfunctions, so we'll replace the lambda n with id slash. So all I've done here is a Fourier transformation and use that I d slash phi n is lambda n phi n. Next, okay, so it's got somewhat a messy expression here, but this is just really taking our definition, inserted a regulator, and Fourier transformed. Next, we can use the completeness relation in Fourier space. So the Fourier transform, the completeness relation. So that if we Fourier transform our completeness relation, that just tells us that phi n k prime phi tilde n of k, 2 pi, fourth, delta k minus k prime, times the spinner identity. Then we get trace theta gamma 5, the limit lambda goes to infinity, integral d4x, d4k, theta trace gamma 5. And we can Taylor expand f. Taylor expanded F. Around k squared over lambda squared. And well, now we see we still have. So let's look at our expression here. So we still have two integrals, our function theta's traveling around. And here we've got a trace over gamma 5 times a product of 2n gamma matrices. So there's 2n gamma matrices hidden as I e slash the 2n. And then over here, we've got a lambda to the 2n. So there's two ways we can get rid of terms in this sum, which is why this expansion is a useful thing to do. So one is terms of sufficiently large n are going to go away in the lambda goes to infinity limit. And terms with sufficiently small n are going to die when we take the trace, because the trace of gamma 5 or the trace of gamma 5 with a sufficiently small number of gamma matrices is 0. So this sum, in fact, will only involve a very small number of terms. And that's because trace of gamma 5 is the same as trace gamma 5 gamma mu, gamma nu. Those are both zero. So the terms n equals zero and n equals one vanish. And the term with too many powers of lambda are also going to vanish in this limit. So lambda here is our UV cutoff. And so the integral d4k is basically going to give us a lambda to the fourth. So the term with n equals 2 is lambda independent. But the terms with n equals 3 or larger will still involve powers of 1 over lambda, which will die in this limit. So this integral d4k over 2 pi to the fourth integrated up to lambda, 1 over lambda to the 2n in this limit is 0 for n greater than 2. So we have exactly one term left. It's the n equals 2 term. There's some more algebra I won't go through. These are the important steps to set up the calculation. And so all that's left is a single term that involves the trace of gamma 5 times id slash to the fourth. And these integrals, and the k integral, which can be performed explicitly. So it can be. So essentially, what we need to compute is the trace of gamma 5 d slash to the fourth. And after some algebra, this will become something like e squared epsilon mu nu rho sigma f mu nu f rho sigma. And the angular integrals will give us some pi's and some powers of 2. When the dust settles, what we'll be left with is trace theta gamma 5 is integral d4x theta e squared over 32 pi squared epsilon mu nu rho sigma f mu nu f rho sigma. And so using this equation here, this tells us what the anomalous non-conservation equation is. We just need to take a derivative of this equation with respect to theta, set theta equals to 0.
What happened to determine one of the lambda 4 for n equals 2?
Lambda to the fourth? So this k integral will give us a lambda to the fourth. And then for n equals 2, we've got a lambda to the fourth in the denominator, so that is lambda independent. And so only thing left to do is take a derivative of this equation with respect to theta to get the anomalous non-conservation equation. Where there's an extra, this is in Minkowski space, There's an extra I. Minus I. So this is our anomalous non-conservation equation. And so what would change? So a few comments about this equation. So first of all, what would change if we considered a non-abelian gauge theory instead of an abelian gauge theory? So the answer is not a lot. Basically, almost nothing we did depends on which gauge group we consider. One difference that will arise is that f mu nu will have various components. So, and each of those components will essentially contribute in the same way to the anomaly. And a natural guess of what would change. We had a non-abelian gauge theory, which turns out to be correct, is we just have to retrace. That's the only that's the simplest thing we could do to the right-hand side of this equation that would make it make sense for a non-abelian gauge theory. It turns out to be correct. So you can go by basically going through this derivation again for non-abelian gauge theory. A few other comments. So first of all, I claimed last time that the anomaly comes about because of a clash between the chiral symmetry and the usual, the U1, the global part of the U1 gauge symmetry. So a natural question to ask is where did that play a role here? So why, in what step did we choose to preserve our gauge symmetry instead of our chiral symmetry? And that came about in this step here, where we inserted a regulator that cut off the large eigenvalues of id slash. We could have chosen a different set of eigenfunctions to work with. For example, instead of I times the covariant derivative slash, we could have just chosen I times the partial derivative slash. We could write down, follow through this entire derivation. And what would change is we would see that, the covariant derivative is independent of the gauge field. And so if we followed through this derivation, instead of big D, we'd have small d here. And in the end, we'd get something independent of the gauge field. And so that suggests that we could choose that d mu. J mu is 0. We chose a different regulator. So that may seem problematic. But using a regulator where we cut off the large eigenvalues of I times the partial derivative slash is not a good choice of regulator because it breaks gauge invariance. So we should use the same regulator to compute all of our observables. And if we use the other regulator, the observables we'd find would be gauge dependent. So our gauge symmetry would be broken. So in that sense, we have a choice. It's not much of a choice, but a choice between preserving the chiral symmetry or the gauge symmetry, depending on which regulator we use. So the gauge symmetries are much more important and play a key role in the consistency of the theory. So that's almost always the choice we'll make, is to preserve the gauge symmetry instead of the chiral symmetry.
Yeah.
Are there questions? Okay. A few other comments. So this result turns out to be exact. Furthermore, it's related to in the instantons we studied last week. So you may recall the right-hand side of the anomalous non-conservation equation from last week. So basically, what we saw is that the instantons were basically integrals of this equation. So they were gauge field configurations with non-zero winding number. And they essentially just looked like the right-hand side of this equation. So if we wanted to ask what would change if we considered the gauge field quantum mechanically instead of just the fermion fields, is we would see that the gauge field configurations that would contribute to the right-hand side of this equation would just be the ones with non-zero winding numbers, the ones in the semi-classical limit, that would just be the instanton configurations. So instantons contribute to the anomaly in that sense, if we treat our theory fully quantum mechanically. And so the reason, this is an exact result. So there's one quick way to see that. And that's to look at the eigenfunction gamma 5 times phi n. So for lambda n non-zero, gamma 5 phi n is an eigenfunction. Of id slash. See that? Look at id slash gamma 5 dn. That's using the anti-commutation relations minus I gamma 5 d slash by n is minus I lambda n by n. So gamma 5 by n and phi n have opposite eigenvalues. So there's different eigenfunctions as long as lambda n is not zero, because they're the phi n are an orthogonal set of eigenfunctions. So essentially what we were computing was integral d4x phi n bar gamma 5 phi n. And we've just shown here that gamma 5 times phi n is orthogonal to phi n. So most of the terms here were at zero. So only the terms that have zero eigenvalue can potentially contribute to this. Because for zero eigenvalue, we don't know for sure that gamma 5 phi n is orthogonal to gamma 5. So that tells us and another thing we know is that gamma 5 has eigenvalues plus or minus 1. So this integral is basically just counting up the eigenfunctions with eigenvalue plus one and subtracting the eigenvalues with eigenvalue minus one. And we've shown that this integral is equal to this integral. It depends on the coupling constant. So we have here that difference in integers. So we're just counting. This is the number of eigenfunctions eigenvalue plus 1, plus or minus 1. This is a difference in integers. This is equal to something that depends on the coupling. So we computed something essentially using perturbation theory that depends on the coupling. And we found it's equal to a difference in integers. And well, I briefly argue that. So if there are any corrections to this equation, they should depend on higher powers of e. That still has to be an integer for any choice of the coupling we make. And it's essentially impossible to think of a function that is always going to be an integer for any value of the coupling. And it can be proved that in fact, this equation here receives no corrections at any order in perturbation theory or even non-perturbative corrections. So the fact that the integral of this thing is an integer says that this is exact. And this is known as the Atiyah-Singer index theorem. Okay. So there's a lot more to say about anomalies, but unfortunately I'm essentially out of time. So we've discussed the chiral anomaly. Another important topic, which is discussed a little in the notes, and I'd be happy to discuss with you individually if you'd like. Didn't have time to get to here, is anomalies in gauge symmetries. So unlike chiral anomalies we've been studying, anomalies in gauge symmetries spoil the consistency of the theory. So chiral anomalies can explain physical effects. Gauge anomalies are horrible, and I mean the theory is inconsistent. Nevertheless, the techniques we've used to study chiral anomalies can be generalized, particularly this functional integral derivation to study other cases. And so for those of you taking the standard model may see some more of this, but otherwise I'd be happy to discuss any of these topics further with you. And so after winter school, Jaume will be taking over. So thank you for your attention.